Thank you very much, Your Honor. May it please the court, my name is John Morrison. I am counsel for the appellant Barbara Gibson as personal representative for the estate of deceased husband Johnny Gibson and the heirs to the estate. I would like to reserve 1 minute of rebuttal time. This is a medical negligence wrongful death case involving a failure to diagnose acute heart disease. Johnny had suffered chest pain for 2 months while working on a ranch in Montana. He and Barbara went to the Community Health Center in Lewistown, Montana, and he complained of chest pain, heartburn, pain, and pressure between his shoulder blades. He had a history years ago of gallstones, so the nurse practitioner sent him to the hospital to be tested for that. She did not do a heart workup. She sent him home with opioid pain pills. A week later, when the family was starting to drive back to Colorado at the end of the summer to their home, he had a heart attack. He was taken to St. Vincent Hospital in Billings. They worked heroically over a period of 8 hours or so to save his life, but he died on the operating table. Roughly $165,000 in medical expenses were incurred September 21, 2015 for these services. The bill with itemized expenses is at ER 65. 3 months later, on December 16, 2015, the charges were forgiven under the hospital's charity program. This is reflected at the end of the bill at ER 77. Barbara brought this action for the estate, herself and the adult children. The government admitted liability shortly before trial. Comparative negligence and damages were tried. The district court found no comparative negligence and awarded roughly $578,000 in damages for lost earnings to the estate, loss of household services, and non-economic damages totaling $250,000, which is the statutory limit in Montana. The court awarded no damages for the reasonable value of medical services caused by the negligence, on grounds that the hospital forgave the bills under their charity program 3 months after they were incurred. District court relied on the Newberry and Conway cases in Montana, which are two MedPay insurance cases, and brushed aside the Meek case, which appellants contend, Your Honor, was error. This appeal is governed by Meek, which limited Newberry and Conway, and which corrected misunderstandings that had come out in the Chapman and Willink cases in the Federal District Court in Montana. A number of facts in Meek are strikingly similar to this case. Number one, Meek was a wrongful death case. Two, Meek incurred somewhat less than $200,000 in medical expenses before she died. Three, the hospital wrote off more than $100,000 of those bills. Meek also happened to have Medicare and Blue Cross Blue Shield in that case, but these only covered a third of her bills. The rest were written off. Four, the district court excluded the bills for purposes of the reasonable value of medical expenses as an item of damages. And granted partial summary judgment against Meek as to that element because she did not pay any of the bills out of pocket. Five, the district court in that case cited Newberry and Conway, as the district court below did here, as the basis for the decision. The Montana Supreme Court granted supervisory control and reversed the district court, both on the motion in limine to exclude the bills as evidence of the reasonable value of medical expenses and reversing the district court as to partial summary judgment on the element of medical expenses as an element of damages. Meek held that medical bills are admissible specifically for the purpose of proving the reasonable value of medical services rendered, which is an element of damages that has been recognized in Montana for many decades. As the Meek court said, and I quote, ultimately, there is a factual dispute in the case over the nature of the bills presented by the medical providers and whether they represent a reasonable value of the services provided. The existence of genuine issues of material fact precludes summary judgment.
So let me just ask you, why should she be allowed to recover the medical expenses that the hospital forgave?
There's several reasons for that, but we start with the fact that the NEAT court says specifically that the entire medical bill is evidence of the reasonable value of medical expenses.
As I read the record, that doesn't seem to be disputed. My question for you, though, is the hospital forgave the bill, right?
She yes.
She didn't pay it. Is that right?
That's correct, Your Honor.
It didn't, from what I could tell from reading the record and the briefs, the hospital did not reserve it a right to come after her if she, in the event she recovered against the third-party tortfeasor. Is that right?
That's correct, Your Honor.
Okay, so why should she be allowed to recover that money?
Well, I would answer it in two ways, Your Honor. First,
wouldn't that be, as they say in the case law, a sort of a windfall for her?
Well, the windfall argument has been addressed for a long time in the common law of collateral source. If there's going to be a windfall, better that it be enjoyed, if at all, by the innocent injured party rather than the tortious wrongdoer. And the government here stands in the shoes of the wrongdoer. But from another standpoint,
in what sense is it a windfall to the government as tortfeasor? That is to say, a tortfeasor should have to pay everything that the injured person lost. And here, the injured person did not lose what they had to pay to the hospital because they didn't have to pay anything to the hospital. So it's not an offsetting windfall, is it? I mean, how can you legitimately say the government gets a windfall if it doesn't have to fork over the unpaid bill?
The way that the wrongdoer would get a windfall is that there is an element of damages in Montana. It is recognized historically in the Anderson case, in the Kunkey case, in the MPI pattern instructions 25.07 of the reasonable value of medical services. It is expressly under Montana law, not an element of damages that depends on the amount paid. We cited the Kunkey case from the 1980s that expressly says no statute and no case law requires the payment of medical bills before the payment can be recovered in a wrongful death case. This is the law in Montana. And so if that element of damages is not assessed against the wrongdoer, then it is a windfall to the wrongdoer. But we've also cited public policy arguments, Your Honors. Those include several very important things. One is that if this plaintiff had not been a poor uninsured person, if this plaintiff had been an insured person, then they would have gotten the reasonable value of the medical services. The judge would have allowed the bills in under Meek to determine what the reasonable value of the medical services was. There would have been a collateral source hearing. Then there would have been a main whole analysis. And it's very possible that under the $250,000 general damage cap, the court would find that the plaintiff was not made whole and the plaintiff would not have to repay. Therefore, we have a poor uninsured person who gets less than what a more affluent, privileged, covered person.
I'm sorry, Ken, that last part sounded as though you were saying there would be a procedure where the insurance company would not be able to get the amount that was assessed as damages because of what the insurance paid out. That is the way I would have thought of it is if the insurance covered $100,000 in medicals and the court awards $100,000 in medicals, then the insurance company is going to get that back from the victim. Were you saying there's a procedure where that doesn't happen?
That's correct, Your Honor. In Montana, the collateral source rule was set forth at 27.1308 Montana Code, and it provides that all of these damages are awarded in the trial, and then subsequent to the trial, there is a collateral source hearing, and the judge makes a determination if the plaintiff was made whole, and only if the plaintiff was made whole does the collateral source have to be repaid. And so if there is a plaintiff that has insurance or Medicare or Medicaid, then that obtains. If there is a plaintiff that has nothing, then there was no collateral source.
But in what circumstance would the, quote, plaintiff not have been made whole if an award is given for medical amounts paid out is the equivalent of it and has already been paid by the insurance company? How could they not be made whole for that? Is this a theoretical possibility, or does it happen all the time that afterwards the insurance company comes up dry and the plaintiff gets to keep that money? That just sounds very odd to me. Now, I say I'm not from Montana, but I'm here to help you. So you can you give me some help there as to whether it's just theoretical or why it would happen?
Well, it's not a matter of record, Your Honor, but as a practical matter, it happens all the time. In this particular case, one good reason to think that the trial judge, if he was doing a made whole analysis, might determine that the plaintiff was not made whole, is that there's a $250,000 damage cap on non-economic damages, and it so happens that the trial court's allocation of non-economic damages was exactly $250,000. That was for the pain and suffering of the decedent, for which the judge awarded zero, for the grief and loss of society and companionship of the surviving spouse, for the grief and loss of society and companionship of each of the two adult children, which are compensable in Montana, and all of that can't add up to more than $250,000, so the court allocated damages in exactly the amount of $250,000.
So, okay, why don't we hear from the government?
Excuse me, Judge.
Just go ahead and finish up, and then we're going to hear from the government. You finish your sentence, what you were saying?
Yes, I'm finished, Your Honor.
Okay, let's hear from the government. I'll give you a minute for rebuttal.
May it please the court, Tim Tatarka of the District of Montana on behalf of the United States. The district court here correctly observed, and this is an excerpt of the record, page 28, citing Montana law, that the purpose of tort is to award damages that puts the injured party back as close as possible to the pre-tort position, neither better nor worse. Here, it's really undisputed that what the plaintiffs are asking for in this case is an award of the $165,000 of medical expenses that they didn't have to pay and won't be asked to pay in the future. And the district court was correct.
Can I just jump in right there and sure. Just ask you, I looked in the record to see if there was any documentation that when the hospital extended this or covered this under its charitable program, that they waived any right to seek recovery in the event she recovered against the tort fees. Was there any documentation of that in the record?
I don't believe there's any documentation of that beyond what's at excerpts of the record page 65. At the beginning of that bill is the amount saying the letter saying that all the accounts are settled here, and the other fact that I think is important, and it's related to your question, although I don't know it's directly responsive, is as the court notes at excerpts of the record, page 18, and referencing the transcript, this isn't a case where Ms. Gibson had been billed for months and months. It's clear from the record that the only bill that she received is this zero balance bill. And again, that just goes to the sort of basic tort principle here, which is there really was never a detriment to the injured party here. The amount that she was billed, the bill that she received, was for $0.
Can I ask you to help me understand how this would normally work in Montana? I will confess that I didn't find either your brief or the plaintiff's brief all that helpful, because you guys rely mostly on the case law, and it just doesn't seem to me that the cases help us very much in this particular instance. So let me describe for you how I think this should work, and it's adverse to your position, so I want you to tell me why I might have Montana law wrong. First of all, you would concede, I gather, that under the normal traditional common law collateral source doctrine, the plaintiff here could recover the full value of the medical services, regardless of whether they were forgiven or whether somebody else paid the amount. Do you concede that? I'm talking about under the traditional common law.
Yeah, I think that's correct.
Okay, so, and is that the background legal principle that governs in Montana? Has Montana adopted that aspect of the common law?
No. The Montana uses, there's a statutory collateral source.
Exactly. Okay, so that's what I'm trying to figure out. So the background rule would normally allow the plaintiff to recover, potentially here, all $165,000. What you would then say, though, is that Montana has displaced the traditional common law rule to the extent that this 27-1308 applies. Is that right?
Okay, let me, I think I need to revise my answer to your first question, because the collateral source rule, we don't think the collateral source, you even get to the common law collateral source rule in this case, where what you have is an adjustment to the bill.
Let me stop you there, because you're wrong about the common law rule. The common law rule is very clear that it doesn't matter from the defendant's standpoint what happens to the amount the plaintiff was billed, whether it was forgiven in full, whether it was paid in part by insurance. The common law rule is that the defendant really doesn't get any benefit from any of that. The plaintiff just gets to recover. Okay? So what I'm trying to figure out is, to what extent is that the background rule in Montana? And if that is, in fact, the traditional common law rule has been adopted there, I'm guessing that the only way you could prevail is if you could show that that rule has been displaced in some fashion by the statute, right?
If that is the common... Under the premise that the common law rule would apply, then the question would be, it is a statutory way that Montana works work around that. And again, we would say, if you look at it in terms of saying those bills are incurred at the moment of service, or those costs are incurred at the moment of service, then you would look to the statutory Montana statutory law, and which says that that all of that comes in, and the entire amount of the bills comes in. The fact that they were paid would stay out in front of a jury. I don't know that that's as much of an issue in front of in a bench trial. But then afterwards, that would be reduced under the collateral source statutory collateral source rule.
If the amount forgiven qualified as a collateral source payment, right, under the statute, and that's where I guess I need your help, because when I look at the definitional provision, 27-1-307-1C, I don't know if you have that in front of you. I hope you do.
I can get pretty close. Okay.
It seems to me that this forgiveness by the hospital gets excluded from the definition of a collateral source payment under the Montana statute, which means that it cannot be deducted from the plaintiff's recovery. And so we're just back to the traditional common law rule, which means that she recovers everything. So that's what I need your help on. Because if you can't explain to me why that's wrong, I would be prepared to rule against your position here.
And you're saying that that the reason why that's excluded under 1C is because it isn't a payment?
Because it's the last clause, except gifts or gratuitous contributions or assistance. It seems to me that's what this qualifies as under the except clause. And so it's excluded from what is defined under Montana law as a collateral source payment. And if you go back to the 308 statute, those are the only payments that get deducted. So it seems to me you've got here a gratuitous, a gift or gratuitous contribution that gets excluded. So anyway, can you help me understand how 1C works or doesn't work here?
Well, I don't know that there's any... this isn't an argument that the plaintiffs have made, I think there will be a question about, obviously it's called charity care, but the hospital is, as a nonprofit hospital, has an obligation to do a certain amount of charity care, and there's a reason for that gets a deduction. So there may be a question as to whether or not this would count as gratuitous on behalf of the hospital. And again, I would go back to our earlier argument, and I know you disagree with it, but I would go back to the earlier question about to say whether or not, given that the only bill that the plaintiff received is a zero balance bill, whether or not we even get to the collateral source rule.
Well, would the question be, is the gift or gratuitous contribution language, designed for when your rich uncle or Bill Gates writes you a check for $100,000 to help you out, as opposed to someone taking care of you and simply not billing you? Is that a gift that the statute contemplated? Isn't that closer to your way out of that?
Yes, I think that is better stated than I did. And again, we'd be happy to brief this issue. Again, this is not an issue that is raised in any of the briefing here or in the court below. And we'd be happy to get a more concerted answer to it, because that isn't something that I thought a lot about prior to this. So. So I don't think it was raised, that issue was raised. We're happy to do a post-trial briefing on it, but that's the best answer I can give you at this point. And if the court
anything
has
else?
No, if the court has no further questions, we'll ask for the court to affirm.
Okay, I'll give the appellant 1 minute for rebuttal.
Collateral source statute. I think that the 27.1307 sub C definitional point about gratuities is very well taken, but it's also clear from the primary definition in the first section of that statute, Your Honor, that the collateral source statute only applies to payments. And there was no payment here. But I would also note, circling back to the Meek case, that this case specifically finds that the full medical bill is relevant to the determination of the reasonable value of the medical services, even in a case where most of those expenses were forgiven by the hospital. And in that case, it was pursuant to a PPO contract or statutory reimbursement schedule. While the McKinnon dissent was rejected by six of the judges, And while the McKinnon dissent closely tracks the government brief and the district court decision in this case, and relies on Newberry and Conway, there is a paragraph that suggests that the dissent even would agree with our position, and it is paragraph 34. And she says what her real problem was in that case was that the hospital had agreed before the services were rendered not to accept that money. Whereas in this case, the hospital did not have any such agreement, and 3 months passed between the rendering of the services and when the hospital made a decision under charity to forgive this bill. And so the bill was incurred. There was a detriment. And I would also ask the court to look at our public policy arguments or our considerations of the implications of this ruling with respect to that detriment. Because here we have some, excuse me, Your Honor.
You're over the time that I allotted, the extra time I allotted you.
I apologize. Thank you. We ask that the court reverse and reinstate the medical bills for the reasonable value of medical services.
Okay. Thank you very much, counsel. We appreciate your arguments this morning.
Thank you.